Hey, Art of Power fans, I'm Susie Ahn.
And I'm Esther Yoon-ji Kang. We've got a new podcast here at WBEZ that we think you'll like.
It's called Shoes Off, a Sexy Asians podcast. And we're going to share our first episode with you right now. Enjoy.
Growing up, we didn't have a lot of good Asian representation in pop culture. Asians were ignored, fetishized, or made fun of.
But we're putting all that to rest with this new podcast. It's called Shoes Off, a Sexy Asians Podcast.
Each week, we'll hang out with a badass Asian making waves in film, music, comedy. We'll talk about identity, their work, and how to redefine the word sexy on their own terms.
And this is our very first episode!
Woo! Woo!
Our first guest is comedian, writer, actor, overall dreamboat, Joel Kim Booster.
But first, Susie, I texted you a couple of weeks ago. I was sitting on the toilet.
Thank you for setting the scene for us.
I wasn't pooping. I was just clipping.
Oh, okay, thank you again for setting the scene for us.
Clipping my nails sitting on the toilet. And I was like, oh, shit, why are we making a podcast right now when there's a billion podcasts out there? Like, what are we doing?
I mean, you know, a part of it is to get away from our normal jobs, which is news. And that can be depressing, just generally depressing. But like in recent weeks, it's even more depressing. You know, I mean, I think of like the recent shootings in California. Mm-hmm. Those are shootings that affect our community. Mm-hmm. Anti-Asian hate has been on the rise for the past few years. And so in a way, like, this podcast is sort of like a source of joy for us specifically, hopefully for others.
I mean, sexy Asians definitely are a source of joy. And the other part of it is, like, I think I really want to celebrate the wins, right? All the great accomplishments that Asian Americans, Asians in general have had, trailblazing at so many award shows in so many areas. But it's also just been really fun to be able to talk to these amazing people.
Yeah, and just like, you know, celebrate together, right?
For sure, for sure.
And originally it was pitched as the Sexy Asians podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, that was something that you really wanted to make sure we had in there.
It's
Sexy
Asians. Sexy Asians podcast. What else do we need?
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but like for me, it's just sort of triggering sometimes seeing sexy and Asian next to each other, just because, you know, in high school, there was like a construction worker who tried to ask me out by leaving notes on my car addressed to sexy Asian baby. It's like it just goes to like that whole fetish thing.
He ruined our podcast name. Well, also, I mean, there was also the Google implications, right? Like if you Google sexy Asians, it's not good.
Yeah,
don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't even look it up on Twitter. It's not a good idea.
But, I mean, adding shoes off is very culturally relevant. But also, like, I don't know, I feel like a little bit of warmth when I think about that. Like, I'm coming to my home. I'm going to a friend's house, and I'm taking my shoes off.
That's true.
But anyway, you know, like, the whole idea of sexy, though, it's not just about physically sexy or being hot, you know? We're talking to really amazing people. Sexy can be smart. Sexy can be funny, talented.
Yeah, and we looked around and realized that there are so many sexy Asians out there. In fact, I think there's enough for like 10 seasons of this podcast. Hint, hint to management. And we are excited to talk to some of them on the show.
Yeah, like today. Our sexy Asian guest is Joel Kim Booster. He's here to talk about being fetishized in the gay community, embracing his identity as a Korean adoptee, and hitting his stride in comedy and film.
That conversation is coming up. Stick around. All right, Susie, our sexy Asian guest today has beefy traps and an actual six-pack.
Yes, he does. But he's not just a pretty face. He wrote and starred in the runaway hit Fire Island. And he's still on fire. You can see him on basically every streaming platform, Hulu, Netflix, Apple TV+.
And I love his personal story. He was adopted and he grew up right here in the Midwest, not too far from Chicago, actually. And you can tell he's really thoughtful and reflective and also pretty sweet.
Joel Kim Booster, welcome to Shoes Off, a Sexy Asians podcast.
Wow, what an intro. I truly couldn't have asked for a better intro.
All right. Well, what we like to do, Joel, at the beginning is ask all our sexy Asian guests, at what point in your life did you think, you know what? I am sexy. I am one sexy Asian.
Wow, that's tough. I think it probably didn't happen for me until my 30s, honestly. Mm. And I've said this elsewhere too. I started identifying as hot before I really believed it myself. And it was a conscious decision I made in my stand-up act, because when I started doing stand-up, I was following in the footsteps of a lot of other Asian comedians who really took the route of saying like, oh, I'm so undateable, I'm so unattractive, I'm so undesirable because I'm an Asian man in America. It's really hard not to internalize that, I think, as a performer and as a person. And it really took a toll on my self-esteem. And creatively, too, it just became really uninteresting because that's what we all were doing, you know? And I don't fault the comedians that came before me, because it's one thing to go out on stage and sort of supplicate yourself to the audience and sort of put your status lower than theirs. It's easier in a way, but it's another thing entirely to go out on stage and say, I'm hotter than you, I'm better than you, and to keep the audience on your side. So like I started doing that in my sets before I believed it. And then it slowly led to a really big transformation, not only in my physical self, but in just like my emotional and my mental self.
Yeah. So you talk about your physical self. When do you feel like you had a glow up, like a physical glow up?
I mean, that happened like late 20s, early 30s. I would say it really started when I quit my day job, basically, because when I was coming up in comedy, I was working 45, 50 hours a week at a startup. And then I was doing open mics at night and shows at night. And that doesn't leave you a lot of room for self-care, you know? Yes. As the deeper I got into the business, the less control over my life I felt like I had. And I felt like the gym was like one place in my life where I had complete control. That is one source of comfort for me in a world where my entire life is in the hands of usually some straight white guy in a suit at a studio.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, through this podcast, we're trying to reclaim the word sexy. I mean, as Asian women, we are regularly fetishized, like, you know, dudes trying to pick us up by saying something like, I'm into Asian girls, which, I mean, I don't know if that line ever works on anyone, but I mean, you've experienced this yourself, and we've got a clip of you talking about that in your 2019 debut stand-up album, Model Minority.
There's a lot of guys in the gay community that fetishize Asian men, and we have a term for that. We call them rice queens. I'm sure there are many of you in the audience tonight. I have a base of them, you know? They're the only ones who are gonna buy this album, and I've made my peace with that.
So what are some of the weirdest interactions you've had with rice queens?
The one, the big one that I talk about, I believe, in both that album and in my Netflix special, it's a different joke about the same story, is having a guy tell me after post-coitally that I didn't have sex like an Asian guy. And what I don't get into in the bit is that conversation sort of spiraled into other areas where it was like, he just didn't feel like, I just didn't behave like a normal Asian person in bed, whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah.
And so I experience like weird dysphoria all the time as an Asian adoptee. You know, I struggled a lot growing up with like what I was. And, you know, I think like moments like that really highlight that dysphoria for me, where I'm like, am I different? Am I abnormal? Am I, you know, like, and it pulls me farther away from being able to connect to my identity as an Asian person when I hear things like that, because it makes me question, like, you know, am I a part of this community? Is there something about me that intrinsically separates me from the community that I'm a part of?
Yeah.
And it makes me weary of certain types of guys, you know, and it's difficult to know, like, at the end of the day, if you're going to get back to their apartment and they're going to have a katana on the wall and geisha makeup in the wings waiting for you.
Oh, gosh.
It's always the struggle.
Well, you know, kind of on the flip side of that, you are currently in a relationship, seems to be going well. But that also seems to have invited criticism from people who think, you know, you're too white or not Asian enough. And as someone who is married to a white person, I can relate to that.
Condolences.
Yes. I mean, how have you grappled with that?
I talk about this a little bit in my set now, but I find myself getting really preemptively defensive and like explaining the kind of white person that my partner is. And I'm always like, you know, I'm the first Asian person he's ever dated. He doesn't even like Asian people. He hates Asian people, you know, like, and it spirals out of control. It is really difficult because there is this sort of like currency that exists online as a person of color that when you reveal that you're dating a white person, you sort of get docked.
Yeah.
You know, like I can't post a photo of my boyfriend anymore. Because I know that when I do, I'm going to get like a deluge of DMs. I'm going to get a bunch of shitty comments on the photo. And it just becomes, it's not worth it for me to deal with it. Because the thing is like, you know, it would be one thing if I was engaging with people who were critiquing it in good faith, but it's mostly just guys saying like, oh, of course you're one of those white worshiping Asian guys. We always knew you were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, how do you engage with that? Like what response is there to that, to a stranger, you know?
Yep. Yep. You know, we could talk about this all day, but I really, really am interested in your comments about being adopted. You were born in Jeju Island in Korea, and you were adopted by a white evangelical family in Plainfield, Illinois. Shout out Plainfield. You talked about not really having a longing to connect to Korean culture when you were younger. So what's that like now?
I should clarify that was the attitude I had as a young person. Mm. And I think it was born out of wanting to feel as normal as possible in a situation in which I felt abnormal everywhere I went. You know, I didn't necessarily feel like I fit in with the very few Asian people that I was interacting with. I felt sort of locked out of those communities. Mm. And I never felt, and I still don't feel completely comfortable in communities that are mostly white. You know, it is this thing that I think is really specific to Asian adoptees, where you're stuck in the middle and you don't know where you fit in. And different people have different responses to this. I think I know a lot of Korean adoptees who have sort of thrown themselves into Korean culture or whatever their specific diaspora culture is, and really rejected their Western roots, and I celebrate that, but it is not something that like feels right to me. Mm. Like I am really interested in the experience of us as a racial group, of what it means to be Asian American, which is a relatively new term that we don't talk about. I think we take it for granted that, you know, we have some sort of unifying factor about being Asian American, but we are made up of many different diasporas and cultures, and that doesn't necessarily coalesce into one, you know, monoculture as a race. But I am really interested in figuring out what those things that do bring us together, like the experience of living in white America, how has that affected us as a racial group? You know, I may not culturally align with a Chinese person or a Thai person or any of our Southeast Asian brothers and sisters, but we've all experienced the same kind of racism. We've all been flattened. Yep. We've all been sort of like given this cultural identity that was not ours, that we did not ask for. And how are we collectively dealing with that as a racial group is really the question that I've always been really interested in. And I think that is sort of where I'm at in my journey. And then quite frankly, like learning where I was born in Korea and the history of Jeju. And it wasn't until I did the research and figured out where I was born that I felt connected specifically to my Korean heritage. And it's something that I really want to delve deeper into. As the older I get, the more my heritage has become this thing that I really want to make a bigger part of my life.
Have you ever thought about what it would have been like if you grew up in Korea?
Yeah, all the time. All the fucking time. It's like my sliding doors, like life, you know, like especially knowing where I was born and the culture around where I was born. I just, it's really difficult because I'm so happy that everything happened the way it did because I'm where I am now, but it's something I think about a lot.
Mm. Have you ever read the book All You Can Ever Know by Nicole Chung?
Yes, I have. I love Nicole. Nicole was one of the earliest editors that ever hired me as a freelance writer.
Oh, wow. So, that's awesome. Yeah. I did not know that. Well, so she wrestles in the book, you know, with a question about whether adoption was a positive thing or not. And it's very nuanced. What would you say about your own experience?
Yeah, that's a big question that I've been wrestling with myself. And I think that adoption in general is a really complicated issue. And it's one that I think we're sort of peeling back the layers on right now and wrestling with some of the more complicated aspects of adoption. I can't go back and change anything about the way I was raised. And I'm really glad that everything that has happened to me has led me to this point in my life in which I'm very happy and feel very together as a person and strong and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do I think that adoption, specifically transracial adoption, is the best option? I don't. I think the best option is to put systems in place that keep families together as much as possible and make it so that adoption isn't the option that we're sort of a person is forced into. But barring that, you know, that's not the reality that we live in. You know, those systems aren't in place yet. And I think that if there are families out there that are equipped to handle the sort of difficulties of adoption and specifically transracial adoption, then there are children in need who do need that right now. I think that white people often sort of downplay the struggle that they are now introducing into a child's life via the experience of transracial adoption. And transracial adoptees have a lot of different opinions about this and a lot of different experiences. And I don't want to speak for anyone but myself, but I think that the one thing we can agree on is that, yeah, I don't think a lot of white parents who adopt children who are not white understand always the complications that are going to arise from that experience and the dysphoria that's going to happen to their children. So there's just a lot to think about. And I don't think there's an easy answer right now. But I do think, again, I think the focus should be on supporting families and making sure that adoption is the last scenario that should occur, if possible.
Yeah. I grew up in Alabama, and I feel like because I knew a lot of homeschooled kids.
Yeah.
And I know that you were someone who was homeschooled until 16. That's like a hormonal time. I mean, was that just sort of like a crazy time to make a switch into like a completely different social setting?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is I was always a really sexual kid and it was all in theory for so long. And then I got to high school and suddenly I was smelling Axe body spray for the first time. And I was like, oh my God, like it went in very quickly from theory to practice. And it was really overwhelming, the opportunities that I had to explore my sexuality suddenly for the very first time. And I came out really quickly after coming to public school.
So with those changes and going from like a very evangelical conservative household, were there conflicts with what you were hearing, the messages you were hearing about yourself and your body from a faith perspective, from your parents?
Oh, yeah. I mean, abstinence was the name of the game in my house, and it was very clear that anything else was not acceptable. And, you know, that's why I eventually, like, it led to a lot of conflict with my family. And I moved out when I was 17, didn't really reconcile with my family again until I was in, you know, basically in college. And it took a long time, and it's still, you know, not necessarily something that has completely healed in my family. And it's certainly like kept them away from my work. Like, I don't know. I think like my appearance on Jeopardy was maybe the first time my mother has ever seen me on television. But it's not something that I have a lot of grief over because, you know, I found people to support me in the ways that a lot of people's parents support them. And I don't necessarily need that kind of validation from my family. And I let that go a long time ago.
It's interesting thinking about like found family. And I know that you went to high school with drag queen Shea Coley.
Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, it's like, you know, the two of you are like two of three famous people from Plainfield. Do you ever get together to look at how far you've both come?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time we see each other, we always sort of kiki and just like laugh. I think like could because neither Shay nor I think people considered us especially exceptional while we were in high school, you know, and like I don't think either of us were the people in our class that people would point to and say, yeah, those two are going to make it someday. And so it's really gratifying to be those people now. It's lovely. It's a really lovely connection.
Do you guys let the other famous person from Plainfield, Melissa McCarthy, kiki with you guys?
Not so much? Yeah, I don't think either of us have interacted or met Melissa yet, but she is definitely welcome. She's welcome to the barbecue anytime.
You touched on this a little bit, but your relationship with your family was fraught after your parents found out you were gay. Reading your journal, I mean, that is just crazy. What do you think it will take to heal that?
You know, there's a lot of healing that's already gone on. Like I brought my partner home to see my mom for the first time. It was the first person I've ever brought home to visit. And I think a big part of that was my dad passed away during COVID. And that was really hard on our family. And I think for my mom, especially, you know, it was a big wake up call almost of we don't have enough time to fuck around. Yeah. You know, we just don't. And I think that even though she's still very religious and has her own opinions on me and my lifestyle, I just don't think it's worth it for her to keep those walls up and not be a part of my life in that full way, you know? And so this person I told her is really important to me. And she understood that and, you know, didn't want to pass up a chance to be a part of my life in that way. Yeah. And so that's growth. And, you know, there are things that we'll never align on, but for me, I mean, she's been so supportive of this relationship and that's all I can ask for.
Yeah. And, you know, also like later on, your older brother came out as gay as well.
Yes.
I mean, did that change anything in the family dynamic? I mean, I've heard that you two are very different people.
Yeah, not really. My brother's still very conservative, and I think that made it easier. And plus, like, he came out several years after I came out. And so they had already sort of gone through the trauma once. And I think by the time he came out, it was a little bit easier for them to swallow, mostly because he wasn't out there talking about his life in the way I was, or, you know, being quite as sexually open as I was. And I think it was just easier for them to deal with that.
After the break, we find out why Joel Kim Booster rewrote the script for Fire Island and dig up his old Tumblr. Plus, we'll play a round of rapid-fire questions we like to call extra credit. Stick around. You know, we found your Tumblr. And
oh, God. Oh, my God.
It's so sweet, Joel. It's really sweet.
I know how to find my Tumblr at this point.
Well, in your diary, you talk about how in your 20s, you're juggling a full-time job at Groupon. That was the startup. Mm-hmm. And you're performing at open mics in Chicago. And in 2014, you wrote, you weren't completely over Chicago. Take us back to that time. And are you over Chicago now?
You know, having just been to Chicago over the holidays and experiencing sub-freezing I can safely say I'm over Chicago. But no, I think like the community of Chicago that I was a part of, I've never felt so supported. And I think that's a really hard thing to leave behind. And it's I think it's why people stay in Chicago for sometimes too long, because it's a really intoxicating kind of support. You know, like I have never experienced the kind of support as an artist that I experienced in Chicago from this community of people that just are so interested in lifting each other up. Mm. And then I moved to New York where, you know, I made an incredible group of friends and I don't want to discount that, but everyone was sort of in their own lane, really focused on themselves in a way that you have to be when you're in New York. I don't fault anybody for that. I became that person too. But in Chicago, it was much more like looking at each other and lifting each other up and collaborating with each other and figuring out ways in which, like, how can my art be in conversation with yours and create something new and interesting and fun. And the stakes felt so low. It was just like, yeah, let's like have this night where, you know, people do stand up and burlesque and like mix it all together and see what comes of it. I'm speaking of the Fly Honey show in Chicago, which I believe is still happening. So if you're in Chicago and you ever have the opportunity to see the Fly Honey show, please go. It's still to date, like one of the most, in terms of energy, just like best experiences of my life. I, you know, one of my favorite places to perform today.
Yeah. Well, not to stay on Tumblr, but I think it was your last entry was about your sexual failures of 2017.
Oh my God.
If you went back to your Tumblr now, what would you write?
Huh. It's interesting. It's a muscle that I wish I had exercised more during the pandemic, but I would probably write a lot about my relationship. I spent so much of my 20s imagining what it would be like to be in love. Mm. All I wanted was a relationship and a boyfriend. And then I hit my late 20s and early 30s and I let that go a little bit more and I wasn't more interested in having fun. But I spent so long considering what it would be like to be in love that I never really stopped to consider what it would be like to be loved. Mm. And I think like that is the biggest thing that I've really learned in this relationship is that like, it's easy almost to imagine what it's like to love another person. It is one thing entirely, though, to be loved and feel loved and to feel it deeply and sort of tangibly in your life. It's next level. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I can't believe I spent so much of my life not knowing about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure that 2017 Tumblr Joel would be so proud of you now. Congratulations on Fire Island, by the way. People called it smart, fun, gorgeous, and a Jane Austen adaptation done right and gay. You loosely based the film on Pride and Prejudice. What other books shaped you?
Some of them are featured in the movie. Runaway, that was my first Alice Munro that I read, and I remember being really deeply affected by that book and the stories found within. The other book that is featured, but you can't really tell, is I'm reading on the beach, Are Prisons Obsolete by Angela Davis. And that really shaped a lot of how I view the world politically and sort of the possibility of change that can happen in this country if people really understood the systems that are oppressing us. And those are two big ones that I really felt really passionate about including in the movie.
The movie was very groundbreaking on many levels. It was a rom-com with an all-queer, mostly Asian cast. And the group won the ensemble tribute from the Gotham Awards. Ooh. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you cast an Asian love interest in Fire Island. Why was that important to you?
I felt it really important for the story that he be a person of color, I think, because of the connection that these two people felt as like outsiders in this space. And when it was a project at Quibi, we had cast an African-American actor in that role who was unavailable when Searchlight picked it up and scheduling and everything like that. And so we sort of scrambled to try and find his replacement. And I had my heart set on this actor. I did not think there was anyone who could be Will for me beyond this actor. And I remember they sent a tape of Conrad in and I was very skeptical because I was like, it would require me rewriting certain scenes and like the dynamic is different. Like I was really interested in the dynamic of not only just two people of color of different races and sort of the intersection of what they had in common, but also what separated them and what they experienced on different levels within the gay community. But then Conrad came in for a chemistry test and it was just immediately apparent. And I remember he walked out of the room and I turned to Andrew Ahn, the director, and I said, I will rewrite the script for this man. And I'm so glad I did. And I think it became something slightly different, but still really impactful to see in the story. And I'm really proud of that aspect of the film.
Yeah, he was perfect. I thought like he was just like such a great Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, there was a scene that was eye-opening to me in the movie. Let's hear a little bit of it.
There are plenty of other guys.
For you too.
No, stop it. Stop talking about this like we're the same. But we are. You and me.
No, stop! You want to feel so good so badly that you did all this. And now you want me to feel good too because you... I don't know, you feel guilty? Stop pretending like you don't understand how the world works.
So that was a scene from Fire Island with you and Bowen Yang, who was on SNL. And so you don't shy away from talking about the privilege you have with how you look.
Yeah.
Why was it important for you to address body politics in Fire Island?
I think it's such a huge pervasive presence in the gay community. You know, like we talk early on in the movie about currency and the different currencies that gay men trade in, and our bodies are a huge factor in that. And I think like it is something that I feel a small amount of guilt in because I've bought in, baby. I've bought into the system that I wanted to critique in the film, and it didn't feel right for me to go in and say, like, you know, there's intersections because as an Asian man, I am still, no matter how I look, going to be invisible in certain spaces in this community. No matter how many abs I have on my body, I will still be seen and desexualized. And that was like something that I had to really wrestle with in my early 30s of just like, I can't let this being going to the gym, working on myself. I can't let this be about outward validation because if I do, I will kill myself trying to get there. But at the same time, like I was like, if I'm going to talk about this in the movie, there has to be a reckoning with myself about like my relative privilege to Bowen and to people who don't look like this. And it would feel really disingenuous. And I think I would be called out like rightfully if I made a movie that was in part about body image issues within the gay community and I didn't address the fact that I have a rockin' bod. So that was a really important scene for me to write. I felt it was one of the first scenes we shot too, actually. And so it was really difficult and it was like really like going from 0 to 60 with Bowen. And it was, I think it is one of the most important scenes of the movie. And listen, like this movie is my POV. It is about me and my experiences. And I'm going to address the things that I think need to be addressed. But like, I hope and I pray that there are movies out there and there are creators out there who don't look like me, who are going to create their own narratives about this particular experience within the gay community. Like, I would never claim that this is like the one that addresses it all and addresses it all correctly. I hope though that people feel energized after seeing this movie into writing their own.
So you and Bowen Yang, you're good friends, and a mutual friend tried to connect you two, but you avoided meeting him at first. Tell us why. What happened there?
I think it was sort of the method in which we were introduced. It was a mutual friend who said, sort of verbatim, like, you're both gay and Asian, you should know each other. And I think we both felt a similar sort of flattening of our identity in that moment of like, well, there's a lot of other things about us that are not our sexuality or our race. And if this is the only reason you want me to meet this person, then I'm good. You know, like I know plenty. And I think like, it made us both prickly, and it's unfortunate because I think like, you know, we met maybe a year after that introduction was made and we discovered that, yeah, we do have a lot more in common than just being gay and being Asian. And we complement each other in a lot of ways. And he's been so supportive of me and I him. And there is no one, I think, that understands what it's like to be me in this industry more than Bowen and I and vice versa. And I think like there's a version of this story where we're both competing and sort of like shunned each other because, you know, we have been seen for a lot of the same roles. He gets them, I don't. But, you know, ultimately, I'm so glad that we came up in an era where competition wasn't necessarily the only option. And we could just say, no, actually, let's be friends. Let's be allies. Let's lift each other up and let's figure out a way to take over the world together because there's room for both of us.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, it's really frustrating if, like, you know, some media outlet posts, you know, your picture instead of Bones or Bones instead of yours. I mean, Yeah. Like, at this point, I mean, that, like, happens to us sometimes where people just confuse us.
Yeah, I've been called
sleazy. Yeah. And so that must be frustrating when you're out there and you've put out different work and yet this is still happening, that people mix the two of you up.
Yeah. No, it is. It's deeply frustrating. And it happened just recently in Miami. It literally happens so frequently that it's almost, it's like, it's annoying to even talk about now. Like, I just can't believe it's still happening. And it's super disheartening to both of us when it does, because we feel like we've made so many inroads in like making ourselves individuals in this industry. And when those moments happen, it's just like, nope, we will always be just another gay Asian to these people, you know, because we don't look anything alike.
Right.
You should say, like,
not even a little bit.
I'm not wearing glasses. I'm not.
He wears glasses. I'm like 2 inches taller. Our faces are completely different. Yeah. We're different ethnicities, and like, yeah, it is. Our haircuts are different. I mean, it would happen when I was blonde. It would happen. You know, like, it is crazy.
Yeah. Well, you've got a serious career in stand up, acting, and writing. What do you have the most affinity for?
When it really comes down to it, I think the thing that I love the most, that if I had to choose what I would do for the rest of my life, it's writing. I've always been a writer. It's the thing that brings me the most joy and the most satisfaction. Like, don't get me wrong, I hate writing. I hate it. But I love having written.
Right.
That is the best feeling in the entire world. And I enjoy acting and I enjoy stand-up, and I want to do both as long as it's feasible to do them. But if I was locked down, I think the thing that I would want to do the most and spend the most time doing is writing.
Mm. Well, Joel, you do so many things so well. It turns out you could also bake. The Great American Baking Show. You killed it on Celebrity Jeopardy. What else is next for you? Like a clothing line? I mean, any projects you've got coming up?
Right now, all I have coming up is I'm shooting season 2 of Loot, which is on Apple TV Plus, which I'm very excited about. And I have written my second movie, and right now we're just looking for a home for it. So stay tuned on all fronts.
It's a wedding comedy, right?
That is correct, yeah.
Can you tell us a little more?
It's a wedding comedy that explores the experience of being bipolar in a relationship. And it is very much based in what I put my boyfriend through on a daily basis.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, some studio better snatch it up fast. Do you think you've made it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are different levels of that, right? But I feel happy. I feel satisfied. I feel like I'm in this moment now where I'm not worried about my future. And if that isn't making it, I don't know what is.
Before we wrap things up, we like to play a game called Extra Credit. And that's where we just ask you random questions and kind of make it snappy. So the first question for you is, you claim, I don't know if it was a joke or not, but you claim to be a nationally ranked Bible quizzer.
Not a joke.
Whoa.
That is a real
thing. So who is your favorite Bible character?
Oh, wow. Delilah. Now. Ooh. I mean, I love a secret haircut.
Who was your first celebrity crush?
Scott Bakula from Quantum Leap.
Yes. Okay. I can see. Yes.
That dates me a little bit. But yeah, that was definitely it.
Who was your first Asian celebrity crush?
Definitely Chow Yun-fat.
Oh, good one.
Yeah. Rank your Hollywood Mr. Darcy's, and you can count Colin Firth twice for Pride and Prejudice and Bridget Jones' Diary.
Huh. Do I include Conrad in this
as
well?
Yes, you can.
Oh, then it's Colin, Conrad, Tom from Succession, and then I guess Colin bringing up the rear.
What's your favorite spot in Chicago?
That is a tough one. I'm going to say Berlin Nightclub.
Ooh, yeah.
Because I have never been messier in my entire life.
Shoes on or off in the house?
I'm sort of loosey-goosey about this. Okay. My boyfriend, ironically enough, is very pro shoes off. And I am cool dad. And I say, you know, whatever fit, you know, whatever you guys feel like.
Do you have a favorite Korean dish?
Kimchi all day, every day. I buy so much of it and just snack on it all day.
just kimchi, no...
Just kimchi.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Straight out of the container.
All right, so we have two pictures of you from your Instagram. You're shirtless in both of them. We want you to fill in the blank for It's Giving Blank. So we'll start with this one. It's a more recent one.
Very nice. It's Giving Desperation.
And so that's you shirtless, looking out a window, and you've got the reflection. This one here is from 2009. I'm going to say it's like maybe, it seems like it's a family beach vacation, but fill in the blank, it's giving.
It is giving internalized racism, I think. Yeah.
It's super cute though, I think.
Okay, I'm glad.
Well, thanks so much, Joel Kim Booster. You can check out Joel and his movie Fire Island on Hulu. You can also catch him on Loot on Apple TV+. Joel Kim Booster, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
As we chronicle the many people who make up sexy Asian America, we want to be as inclusive as possible.
And to be clear, this is a wide interpretation of sexy.
So to expand our knowledge and database, we've been asking our friends and their friends of friends about who they think we should talk to on this podcast. Here's what we've got so far.
Hi, my name is Josh Kim, and I'm from Orange County, California.
This is Maha from Chicago's Uptown neighborhood.
This is Barry from San Carlos, California.
And I like to think that I'm a pretty sexy Asian myself. But who I like to nominate for the podcast is Stephen Yeun. He was voted top 100 sexiest man alive, and he really brought Asian male sexuality to the forefront.
Someone I think is sexy is Michelle Yeoh. She has such a long career, and after all these like years in the business, it seems like now she's still at the top of her game.
Can you interview Hasan Minhaj? Because he's funny and has awesome takes on things.
And we want to hear from you too. Who's a sexy Asian we should have on the show next and why? Email us a voice memo at shoesoff@wbez.org. We want all the tips. Shoes Off is a production of WBEZ Chicago. This episode was produced by Esther Yoon-Ji Kang, Stephanie Kim, and me, Susie Ahn. Our executive producer is Brendan Banizek.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to like and subscribe.
And leave us a 5-star rating. It'll help us reach more people and bring you more conversations with sexy Asians.
We'll see you next time.
Stay sexy.